This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our Jodbite this week is with someone whose voice will be familiar to many listeners, Hannah Stacey. Hannah came to the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics in September 2014, joining the Extragalactic Astronomy and Cosmology Group as a master's student. She has recently submitted a thesis entitled Investigating Radio Quiet Quasars with Gravitational Lenses. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
What's it like to be, as it were, on that side of the microphone?
Oh, well, yeah, it's a bit surprising. I wasn't really expecting it.
Well, I've never interviewed anyone before either, so it's a bit surprising for both of us. So you investigate gravitational lenses.
Yeah.
You use those as a tracer for quasar activity.
Yes.
Most people are familiar to some extent with what gravity is. Most people are familiar to some extent with what a lens is. What's a gravitational lens?
So a gravitational lens is an effect that happens when you have a background source that is lined up along the line of sight of a massive foreground object. And the light from the background object is lensed or bent around the foreground object. And so the background object can appear magnified, distorted, and in the strong lensing regime, which is the part of lensing that I work in, you see multiple images of the source.
Okay, so you effectively have an object between you and another object. And the fact that that intermediary object is able to distort the space-time around it, you end up seeing parts of the background thing that you wouldn't ordinarily see.
So the background source is magnified, so it appears with a larger surface area and a brighter flux from our point of view than it would otherwise appear to be.
Right, because that light you're receiving, if it weren't for this intermediary object, would go off in another direction and miss the Earth entirely?
Right, it's the same principles as an ordinary optical lens, you know, like a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
It's sort of like having a gravity being used as a magnifying glass to be able to look at these very faint and compact sources in more detail.
Okay. So light that would be either parallel or diverging away from you, this massive object, actually converges that light upon the Earth and we see.
Yeah, exactly. Just like a regular lens.
I see. Okay. So are there different types of lensing?
Yeah, so there are three different regimes of lensing. There is strong lensing, which is what I work with, and that's when you have the source and the foreground object align closely along the line of sight, so you see this multiple imaging effect. Weak lensing is also is an effect used in cosmology, which is the distortions that happen due to the large-scale structure of the universe, so clusters of galaxies and galaxies as a whole, and how they are distorting all the galaxies in the universe.
I see.
And then microlensing at the other end of the scale is an effect that happens within strong lensing, whereby you have a very compact source and that small changes in the gravitational field of the foreground object due to the stars moving in the foreground galaxy sort of differentially magnifies the source object, so it appears to change in flux in brightness over time.
Right, I think I've heard of gravitational microlensing being used to discover planets, where you have a star passing in front of a background object, the light from that background object is magnified, and then the planet passes shortly afterwards, and you see a little dip in the flux as well.
Right, yeah, because the planet also contributes a little bit of gravity to the system, yeah.
So you work in the strong lensing regime.
Yeah.
What sort of images do you see?
So it depends on the particular configuration of the lens system. So if you were to have the source and background object perfectly lined, and the gravitational field of the foreground object was perfectly uniform, then what you would see is like an Einstein ring, so a ring around the foreground object. When you have a very compact source, you might see what's called an Einstein cross. It's sort of a cross-shape configuration. In reality, what you see more likely is different configurations depending on whereabouts the background object is with respect to the foreground object.
Okay.
So you can predict particular flux ratios of the different images, mm-hmm. depending on whereabouts it appears with relation to the foreground object.
Right. It makes sense, right? Because you've got light coming from the background object in all directions. And so if you've got a perfect alignment, you're going to see light coming over the top of it, around the sides of it, around the bottom of it, and you're going to see this perfect ring.
It's just like the effect and light reflecting through your wine glass. And the way that the light moves as you move your wine glass with respect to the source. I mean, that's what how I'm imagining it anyway.
Fair enough. That's really cool. So how do you generally observe these? What electromagnetic bands are they generally visible in?
Well, all bands. It just depends on the light emitting from the source. So it's not dependent on the wavelength of the light. I work in radio interferometry, because the sources that we're looking at are very compact and the lenses are very compact. So you need a very high resolution to detect them.
So what sort of objects tend to form the foreground objects?
Typically, you have massive galaxies. Any object can be a lens, but because of how numerous massive elliptical galaxies are and because of the gravitational field of them, they're more likely to be the lens in strong lens systems.
How were gravitational lenses discovered?
Well, the first gravitational lens was discovered from Jodrell Bank, actually.
Wow.
With the Lovell telescope. It was a double quasar lens. With the system, you have a quasar with a massive jet, and it's just the core of the quasar that has been lensed. So you see two images of the core of the quasar and just one massive jet from the top image.
So was it obvious at the time that what we were seeing in these two images of the same quasar, that they're actually the same object? Or was it thought that perhaps this is two objects that are just very similar in the same patch of sky?
Yeah. So the way that you decipher that is by looking at the spectra of these objects and by comparing the two. And because they were the same, it was quite clear that this was the first lens that they discovered.
I mean, would it have been at all possible for these two images to have been two
different? I think there are examples of multiple quasar systems, or just two sources that happen to be close together. But it was because of the matching spectra of these objects that they were able to discern that it was a lens.
So in your research, you're using these gravitational lenses to trace the activity in quasars. Can you give us a brief reminder of what a quasar is?
So, well, what we think a quasar is something called an active galactic nucleus, which is when you have a supermassive black hole at the centre of a galaxy that's accreting matter and producing this huge amount of energy, which makes them the brightest objects in the universe.
Okay. And what do they look like in our telescopes? How do we see them? Are they quite extended? Can we see them, the internal structure of these things, or are they just little points of light?
Yeah, they're very compact sources. So some of them appear with jets, and some of them don't.
Right.
The jets themselves, they're still a bit of a mystery as how they're produced, but essentially it's because the accretion onto the black hole is quite inefficient, so a lot of it is ejected and radiated, and that's what makes them so bright.
Right, I see. So in your thesis, you've been looking at radio quiet quasars. You've been using radio telescopes to look at radio quiet quasars. So presumably, what does radio quiet mean? It doesn't mean they're radio silent, obviously.
No, it's a bit of a misnomer, really. It doesn't mean they're radio silent. It's a way to distinguish between these two different, apparently, modes of quasar. All quasars are very bright in the optical, X-ray, other wavelengths. But in the radio wavelengths, there's this disparity. So some quasars are extremely bright in the radio, and whereas others are faint and haven't been detected, we haven't been able to detect the radio components of them, and it's not clear what causes this disparity. And the big question is, what is the emission mechanisms of these objects? So we know that in the radio loud quasars, they exhibit these jets, and the emission from these objects is caused by effects of the jets. Whereas the radio quiet regime, the question is, are they powered by the same emission mechanisms, or is it something different? Why are they quiet and not loud?
And why do some have jets and some not?
Yes.
I see. So what is it that you've been looking at, and what have you been using to do so?
So because the radio components of these sources are so faint, they're not able to detect them. We're using this effect of gravitational lensing to kind of it's kind of as a cheat, really, to sort of use it as a magnifying glass to be able to look at these sources that would ordinarily be too faint and too compact to detect.
I see. So you focused on four quasars, and what have you been using to look at those?
The observations that I was analysing were using eMERLIN, which is the radio interferometer based at Jodrell Bank, using 7 telescopes around the UK.
Why 7? Why would it not be possible to do this with just a single dish?
So to be able to get the resolution that you need to observe these objects, you would have to have a dish so big that it would be unfeasible to build. So the distance between these telescopes in eMERLIN, the largest distance, is about 220 kilometres. So if you imagine trying to build a dish that big, it would be ridiculous, and to get the amount of precision that you need as well.
I suspect a dish that size probably wouldn't hold itself up.
Right,
well.
Exactly, yeah. And you need to get it so precise as well to get the quality of the data. Interferometry employs a technique called aperture synthesis. You use these telescopes as elements in a larger virtual aperture. And as the Earth moves, these elements start to fill this virtual aperture. So it's as if you have one really big telescope. The difference is the data that we collect from an interferometer is slightly different from the data in an ordinary radio telescope. It uses a technique whereby light that is coherent will add constructively when they are in phase and destructively when they're out of phase. So if you know the experiment of light passing through a slit, you know that you see a set of visibility fringes, points at which light is added constructively and parts where the light has added destructively. So you see light patches and dark patches. In astronomy, we use this effect and the relationship between these fringes of light and the characteristics of the source. So there's a relationship between those two, and we use that to understand the source in the sky.
So you have four sources that you've been focusing on. What is it you observed?
I observed four of these gravitational lenses. And what was special about these gravitational lenses is the source is in a position relative to the foreground galaxy, so that they are really highly magnified. So this made us able to observe sources that were really faint. In fact, some of the faintest sources ever detected. And these are radio quiet quasars, so we wouldn't be able to observe these quasars if it wasn't for the lensing. So my research is part of a collaboration. So I was using the eMERLIN observations, whereas other members of the research group has some observations with the VLA, which is a different telescope, a different interferometer. And we were observing at different frequencies and then combining the data to better understand the sources. So in my case, I only detected one of the sources, but I was able to use the VLA observations to be able to infer characteristics of the sources based on that. We found some interesting results. So we found out that radio quiet quasars are likely to be a smaller version of the radio loud quasars. So they probably have a very small jet that's causing their radio emission, but it's just much smaller than the jets that you see in radio loud quasars, and that's why they appear fainter. And the reason that we don't observe them is because they are so compact and their jet is milliarcsecond scale, so it's too small for us to be able to resolve with our current technology.
I see. So even though there is a selection effect in that some of these jets are too small to actually resolve and some of them are big enough to resolve, there is still an intrinsic difference between these radio quiet and these radio loud quasars.
Right, yeah. The question is, why is it not a smooth distribution of luminosities across the population? So what we think is the very loud end of the population, they tend to be found within massive elliptical galaxies. So it could be possible that these are a result of mergers, because we know that massive elliptical galaxies are produced by mergers between other galaxies. It's possible that they are loud because the active galactic nucleus has been spun up by this influence of the mergers. So it makes the jets more powerful.
Right.
And that's why they appear so loud.
So two galaxies, possibly spiral galaxies, will come together, form an elliptical galaxy, and the interaction of their cores, their AGNs, their central black holes, causes these jets to be launched from this elliptical galaxy.
Yeah. So
and that's what you're seeing in the radial loud population.
Right, yeah. It makes them more powerful.
Right.
Because the central black hole gets spun up mm-hmm. by the interaction. But it's hypothetical.
Right. So where would a radio quiet quasar come from in the context of that model?
Well, it seems more likely that there is a smooth distribution of radio luminosities across the population, because we know that there is a relationship between the radio luminosity and the optical luminosity of a quasar.
Right.
So we think that maybe the disparity at the radio loud quasar end is due to these mergers, and ignoring that part, the rest of the population is more of a smooth distribution.
I see. So it's those mergers that separate the radio loud ones from the rest of the smoothly varying population. So where's your research going to take you in the future? How long are you going to be around with us now you've submitted?
Well, I'm going to stick around for a little bit longer. I'm doing some more research with some very old Merlin data at a frequency that we no longer observe at because of mobile phones and things.
Ah.
But we're hoping that the data is going to be useful, because we can use it to hopefully solve a problem with low-far calibration.
And LOFAR is?
LOFAR is a low-frequency array based in the Netherlands, but there are telescopes all over Europe, and it observes at a low frequency, a low radio frequency. The issue is, with LOFAR calibration, nothing appears unresolved on the very long baselines of LOFAR, and we need to be able to have a model for the calibrator sources to calibrate against. And because LOFAR is new and we don't have these calibrator sources, I'm hoping this old Merlin data is going to be useful to provide a model to calibrate with on the LOFAR baselines, because it will be about the same resolution. But it remains to be seen if that's going to work yet.
So this old E-Merlin data, is that pre-mobile phone era?
It's a 94, 95.
Wow.
It actually exists in an old file format that no longer exists, so it's a bit of a challenge to try and convert it into something usable.
So you're going to be around here working on that for another few months, and then what's your plan after that?
Hopefully a PhD at some point.
Okay. Excellent. In a similar field, or are you hoping to move on?
I like radio interferometry, so I think I would like to stay in a similar field, but don't quote me on it, you know.
Well, hopefully we'll be seeing you on the Jodcast for a few more months back on this side of the microphone.
Right.
And, all the best for the future, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.